Every river in Japan have two faces, very violent, fierce, fearful, and gentle and kind. Most of the time very kind, but once in a while they get so fearful.
In Japan, we produce much rice, so it was very necessary for people to get access to river. On the other hand, the living along the river means the vulnerable to floods. So we have faced flood disasters so many years.
Radio Netherlands presents The Opening of the Chrysanthemum, the first of two programs about Holland's contribution to the taming of Japan's river demons. The program is produced and presented by Dira Sujan.
Along the river, the life is an entirely different thing in Japan than life in the Netherlands along the river. They play football or baseball. These grounds are available for recreation. They calculate their system for water management as well with a recreational aspect for the population. It's astonishing. Not here. Here, in fact, the dike is holy.
As we live in Japan, which is vulnerable to typhoon and earthquake, we suffered from flood from olden times, repeatedly hit by flood. And it is important that individual Japanese should bear in mind the danger of flood.
This film, shown by the Sabo Museum in the Japanese mountain town of Tatayama, shows the constant threat the Japanese have faced from the elements. For centuries, Japan has waged a heroic battle with its own geography. An island nation with yearly typhoons along its vulnerable coasts and some 3,000 rivers streaking across its landscape, it has a particular vulnerability to floods. Mountains cover much of the country, and densely populated urban centres are packed into the rest. Flooding and landslide are something the country has lived with for centuries. Mr. Tomu Inoue from the Ministry of Water Management in Japan.
Now we have 120 million people in Japan. About 50% of population was on flood-prone areas. And 75% of our properties are on flood-prone areas.
Right. It's very apt. We're hearing the thunder in the background there. I'm sorry, please continue.
Yeah. About 66% of our total land is covered by forest. It means the playing field are very, very, very small. We are very densely populated in the urban areas. Those urban areas are on flood-prone areas under the big rivers. So we have struggled with flood defense and water utilization. It is our history on water.
Dr. Yoshiyuki Kamibayashi is a retired engineer with the Ministry of Water Construction who spent years researching historical engineering projects in Japan.
We're now on Abura Island, in front of a shrine named the Chisui Shrine. Chisui means river improvement, and this shrine was built as a dedication to the people of the Satsuma clan. There's an interesting story behind this shrine. In the 17th century, the shogun Tokugawa began the great work of separating the Kisu and Nagara rivers. These rivers had a history of flooding, and as the land surrounding them was important agricultural land, which belonged to the shogun, he decided to embark on a water improvement project. Now the shogun was a clever man, and was always looking for ways to make himself more powerful and his enemies weaker. So here is what he did. On the southern island of Kyushu was a powerful and affluent clan called the Satsuma. Even though they were very far away from here, the Tokugawa was afraid of them, as he would be of a leopard or a tiger. so he ordered them to contribute both financially and with manpower to this water improvement project here. The shogun also ordered several hundred samurai of the Satsuma clan to come here to Kiso to build dams. The samurai were very proud warriors, and they felt humiliated that they had to do this menial work, which was more suitable for farmers or merchants. So many of them performed the ritual suicide, harikiri, because of this humiliation. In all, more than 80 people of the Satsuma clan died here at that time, either through such suicides or by disease or accident.
Can I go inside? Yes. Okay. Thank
you. We are now in front of the ritual shrine called Chisui Shrine, Water River Improvement Shrine. And we happen to see the people inside attending the ceremony of the Shinto Shrine. And they are descendants of Satsuma clan, maybe the descendants of the people involved with the river improvement work in Tokugawa period.
They clapping hands? What's the ceremony about? What's going on there at the moment?
Just like you go to the pray for your ancestors once in a while in the graveyard or the church, it's the equivalent of the ceremony for your ancestors.
So they obviously, you were saying that the Satsuma clan were not very happy about having to work on this river here, but obviously their descendants have no problem with the history.
That's right, and maybe they come here to console the spirit who died regrettably in many years ago.
From 1639 until 1853, when the American Commodore Matthew Perry pried open Japan to the West, the Netherlands was the only European nation to trade with Japan. The 16th and 17th centuries were the glory days of the Dutch East India Company, the mighty VOC who dominated the Asian trading routes. Willem Remmelink is the director of the Tokyo-based Japan-Netherlands Institute.
Now, the Dutch connection with Japan originates from the first ship that landed here, which was part of the Dutch overseas expansion, as they sometimes called it. But Holland at that time was the major trading power in the world, and Japan came naturally in its orbit. At that time, at least when the first ship arrived, Japan was still an open country. Many people don't realize it because everybody thinks that Japan has always been closed, but it didn't become closed until the 1640s, when, because of the internal political problems, when the Tokugawa shogunate tried to get a grip on the country, and one of its measures was to close off the country from outside interference.
During this period of isolation, all foreigners except the Dutch were expelled from the country. All trade and information about Western science and medicine were from then on channeled exclusively through the Dutch, and even they were restricted to the island of Deshima in Nagasaki Harbor. A select number of Japanese interpreters, scholars, cooks, servants, and even prostitutes were provided to facilitate this strictly controlled contact with the foreigners, the Yatoi.
Japan was, of course, very important for the Dutch East India Company because it was a major copper producer. And bullion was the mainstay of the trade here. And the Dutch were very successful to make a kind of intra-Asia trade network in which they could bring products from one country to another inside Asia and shipped profits off to Europe. So they got the spices from the Moluccans, but in the Moluccans they basically needed rice. They got the rice from Java, On Java, they wanted to have Indian textiles, so they got Indian textiles. But what did the Indians want? They wanted to have copper and money, silver, which they got from Japan. And what did the Japanese want? They wanted Chinese silk. So they got this whole thing nicely working. And Japan at that time was a linchpin of Dutch trade in Asia.
The VOC dissolved by the end of the 18th century, and the British were on the ascendancy in the East when the young Emperor Meiji was restored to the throne in 1868. Like a bear waking up from its long hibernation, Japan was suddenly hungry, and the food it wanted was technology. Western experts were brought in to create new railways, industries, ports and dams. Filmmaker Louis van Gasteren.
From the very beginning, the Meiji government had fears that Japan would be colonized. And they really, at the right moment, made that governmental switch by inviting people to prevent that Japan would have become a colony like Indonesia. So they invited from various countries a lot of technicians.
The Dutch had already made a slight start in Nagasaki with helping the Japanese Navy to develop. There was already a very long interest in Western medicine. There was an interest in military sciences. And in the very beginning, the Japanese naturally looked to the Dutch to give them some information about where to find it, how to get it.
Although the Dutch weren't the most technologically advanced country in the world by the 19th century, when it came to the field of water management, they were the undisputed masters. For centuries, they'd been wresting land from the water, building protective dikes around their country, and battling with the constant danger of flood. Also, their very decline in power in the region was a reassuring sign to the Japanese that they wouldn't be coming in with colonialist ambitions. So, in 1872, at the invitation of the Japanese government, Cornelius van Doorn and Jack Lindo were the first Dutch engineers to arrive in Japan.
Cornelius van Doorn, Jack Lindo, Johannes de Rijke.
Over the next few years, nine other Dutch engineers would follow them.
Rauwenhorst Mulder, Johan Godaar van Gent, Dick Arnst, Johannes Westerwiel, Arie van Maastricht, Josinus Kalis.
Now, it's crystal clear, when you're going to handle water management in another country, you have to look for a fixed point from where you can start. So the oldest one is in Western Europe, in the Netherlands, the Amsterdam Ordens Datum, Normaal Amsterdam's Pijl, and that was created in the 17th century. So when Lindo and Van Doorn went to Japan, the first thing they were looking for was where is a fixed point from where we can start measuring. What we need is to know the height of some point which is fixed, and from there we can then measure the height of whatever river. So the first thing Lindo did was measuring three rivers, the Yeddo, Ara, and the Tone River. Two of them end up in the Tokyo Bay. And the final results of his measurement led to the installation, the calibration of the Tokyo Pijl. Now it is being called Japan Standard. So, although the Japanese, after their teachers, the Dutch, went away, the Japanese engineers became really the world champions in measuring height.
Louis van Gasteren has spent a decade researching the work of these Dutch watermen, as they've become known. Johannes de Rijke and George Arnold Escher, father of the famous graphic artist, were the next engineers to come to Japan to work on a variety of water improvement projects.
There were two things which were important for them. That was the transport, making the rivers ready for transport and deepen them and handle the problem of all the sand coming down from the mountains with the rain as the Japanese cut their trees in the mountains. So then the sand was taken with the rain downwards towards the sea. So the depth of the rivers was not good enough for the transport system. That was one thing. And later it turned out that the British made railroads and that the whole transport was less important than the floodings by which thousands of people died, and it was necessary to build dikes and control the rivers as such. So that is indeed a speciality of the Dutch engineers.
We're now standing at the mouth of the Kiso River. In olden days, because of too much sediment, the bed was constantly rising and the area was flooding. Then the Dutch engineers were asked to come here to do something about the problem. You can see the long dike going into the sea. That was built by Johannes de Rijk. His idea was to introduce a method to take the sediment from the river to the open sea. At that time, this kind of technology did not exist in Japan. But Holland had been building ring dikes for centuries, and this is what they built here. It's called Waju in Japanese, and it's a piece of land surrounded by water. De Rijk was born in Koningsplaat in Zeeland in the Netherlands, and there are many of these ring dikes in Zeeland. So when he came here in 1879, he must have remembered his homeland and decided to apply a similar solution to the problem here.
Dr. Kamibayashi, although the Dutch could use some of their experience with water management back home, the Japanese landscape actually had very different kinds of problems from the flat, waterlogged land of the Netherlands. Yet, combining their excellent technical training with some canny improvisation, the Dutch engineers overcame many of the initial difficulties they faced.
When it comes to water management and control, yeah, then you need the Dutch in that respect. But the circumstances geophysically were completely different. And they were dealing and facing problems which they had never heard of in the Netherlands, as there are no mountains, and our friend Van Duren, he made a tunnel from the Lake of Inawashiro down into the Kanto Plain, and 25,000 families could grow rice, and there was water. So that was an adventure he never learned in Holland, at none of the high schools, but he had the courage and the possibility and the trust of the government to do those things.
Sate, 4th of June, 1872. Dearest Mother, because we are the first Europeans here, we draw a lot of attention. In some villages, the entire population sits at a street corner when we pass. In the tea houses where we stop to rest, a party is apparently organized in the next room where people quietly sit and whisper while watching us. It is remarkable how many children you see everywhere, most of them quite nice looking. When we stay overnight at the tea house, the entire family, one after the other, comes to us offering something, so they can have a good look at us. Above and under the partitions, you constantly see eyes, especially of women and children, who watch your every move with amazement. Every day when I wash and get dressed, I'm usually being watched by lots of eyes on the gallery. And as I fully understand that this must be terribly interesting for them, I let them enjoy the spectacle as much as possible.
Lindo, he writes letters to his mother saying, I want to come into action and I would love to contribute to the prosperity of these Japanese people in the field of agriculture and also in the technical field. They had a sort of illusion to as explorers, as contributors to help. Of course, they were very well paid, extremely well paid. They had the salary of a minister. But their mental framework was of assistance, of contribution, with their knapsack full of technological know-how. So when you read the letters, then you see that, yeah, this is a fantastic adventure.
Some of them developed a great interest in Japan. Others, yeah, couldn't stand it after a while because the final say was always on the Japanese side. And some of them, yeah, just thought about their own things. I mean, the stories you hear about the problems about their pay, I mean, you could compare that with if you have looked at a development project in any developing country these days, and these consultants being brought in from the World Bank and from this and that, and you look at the whole group there, it's not much different, I think. The same kind of characters are walking around there, and the same kind of problems come up, etc., etc.
I find those boat trips terribly boring, mainly because they are so slow. I'd much rather walk, especially in a country like this, where with every step you take, you see something new.
In the first letters Jack Lindo wrote home, his enthusiasm for the newness of what he was seeing and experiencing was obvious, but it wasn't long before the letters took on another tone. He complained of the listlessness of the Japanese workers he had to use. They were slow, he said, and did everything badly. When he left the country 2 years after he'd arrived, his last letter, written from the boat, made it quite clear he'd had enough of everything Japanese.
Yokohama, 5th December 1875. Dearest Mother, it feels as if the last 5 or 6 days here will never end. The moment of sailing away won't be entirely an unmixed pleasure, when Japan, with everything in it, will be buried alive before me or drown in the sea. A few things I'd like to rescue, but may the rest of it perish in peace.
I think in one way it is good that he came straight from Holland. Europeans in those days were usually used to some kind of colonial situation, and also to a situation where they could themselves decide what to do or what not to do, and to tell others what to do. And the strange situation, which was very difficult for many of these engineers coming here, is that they were invited and they were paid rather lavish salaries, and then they found themselves in a country and they could say, okay, you should do this or that, but they didn't control the political situation. It was completely controlled by the Japanese themselves. I mean, they were hired guns and they often didn't realize that they were. It's quite an interesting situation for them, and some of them didn't cope at all. They couldn't stand that they couldn't decide completely what should be done. In the end, the Japanese had to say, okay, we're going to build this or that, or we're not going to build this or that.
Although the Japanese were importing expertise from abroad, they were also sending out their own young talent to acquire knowledge from the outside world, bring it back and put it to good use at home. And while the Dutch engineers in Japan were treated with the utmost respect, their contracts expressly showed that they had to defer the final decisions to their Japanese masters. One can only wonder what the formal, polite, evasive Japanese made of these pragmatic, straightforward Dutchmen, and vice versa. The Dutchman's letters home show definite signs of frustrations that were born out of, amongst other things, the different cultural systems they found themselves in.
We had earthbounders made, but the coolies found them too heavy, so the sleepy, fatherly Yakunins immediately had the pounder's weight reduced by half. When Vestibule came and put his hand under the pounder while they were using it, they nearly dropped to the ground apologizing, saying they hoped they didn't hurt him. They just didn't get it. You see, they lifted the pounder a couple of inches and then gently put it down again. All the while, the sleepy-eyed Yakunins sat there staring blankly, not seeing the sluggishness of the coolies' work.
There were some fellows very punctual and very honest men like Westerwiel. He had a strength and a power that in the letters you find reports on that what he is doing in 1 second is not done in an hour by 10 Japanese who are on the same location working. So that was this, such a classic worker from the polar who knew his job and no discussion. No time for tea or a pipe. Let's do it. I recognize these chaps. They are, for heaven's sake, they are still there in this country. They have made this country. So representatives of this class of people, like Westerwiel, he went to Japan. And there he did not come to meet Dutch people who knew how to act. No, he had to teach hundreds of Japanese what the basic necessity of the system was.
You can look at development projects in Africa where you can build a dam or you can do this or that, where the moment the technical expert leaves, a week later the whole thing falls apart because the local people have not been involved in any essential way. While in Japan, they had a whole group of Japanese officials and other people hanging around who were, yes, to say, massaging the local people to explaining it in all kinds of ways, so that in the end, as a total project, it worked. And it's still there. I mean, you can still go and look at the dams they built, etc., even 100-150 years later. While in many other countries, you can go and, yeah, maybe in the end of the last century, something was built there, but it didn't work and it's fallen into ruin.
What they left was the institutionalization of a scientific approach to water problems. And that's measuring. Measuring is knowing. Meten is weten.
One of the main achievements of Dutch engineers is to enhance the capacity of civil engineers in Japan. One of the most important things to manage river and water resources is how to raise our capacity and our technology and our institutional frameworks.
At the Inawashiro Lake in Japan is a statue of Cornelius van Doorn. Although he and the other Dutch watermen are hardly recognized in Holland, in Japan they've acquired a near legendary status. Statues of them and plaques dedicated to them are dotted around the countryside. There are museums that bear their names, and their old drawings and documents are preserved, relic-like, in the various libraries and prefectural offices around the land. Even the upkeep of the grave of Cornelius van Doorn is paid for by the Japanese city of Koriyama. There were other foreigners in Japan, but it's the Dutch who hold a special place of honor. Why?
The direct thing for the Japanese were, in fact, the Dutch. Why? The British built trains, and they blew the horn, and they passed far away from the rice paddies, and the Japanese looked upwards and saw the train passing, transport from A to B. But the people dealing with the most fundamental thing, rice production, they were dealing with the Dutch. They stood with their feet alongside the river, with one foot in the paddy and the other foot on the dike. So their relationship and their memories for the efforts of the Dutch, that is what you see nowadays in the statues and books and being published almost in a mythological form. But that is a Japanese thing. They have respect for their parents after they have died, and their grandparents. And in fact, they have respect for the sensei, the one who is coming to teach.
Of all the Dutch engineers in Japan, the one with the highest status was Johannes De Reyker. Unlike his colleagues who left after a couple of years' service, De Reyker was to stay on in Japan for a good part of his life, finally earning himself the position of vice minister, the highest post ever given to a foreigner. Next week, the story of Johannes De Reyker, the Dutch sensei.
You've been listening to The Opening of the Chrysanthemum. The program was produced and presented by Dira Sujan. Thanks go to Mrs. Michiko Sasaki for translation and to sound engineer Ronald Hoffman. This has been a Radio Netherlands presentation.